As governments try to get vaccines to people, India's challenge is massive.
If I walk on the streets of India to rural people, to common people, Corona is really a distant name or a concept.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, lessons from Africa on how to earn trust in a vaccine.
People have to trust in science, and there is trust in science when we give them all the information.
And in Indonesia, a militant group goes after perceived enemies of the faith and rails against pop culture.
For example, they engaged in protests against Lady Gaga.
Opponents say, hold on, Indonesia is a democracy. And the government agrees. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Health professionals in India are gearing up to begin the world's most ambitious vaccination campaign ever, getting shots to the majority of Indians, a country of 1.3 billion people, won't be easy. But the government has begun practice runs for the mass vaccination effort, so they'll be ready. And this weekend, drug regulators in India approved two vaccines for emergency use. One is the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. The other, called Covaxin, was developed in Hyderabad, India, by Bharat Biotech. All of these developments are being watched closely by Brahmar Mukherjee. She's a professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan, but she's in Kolkata, India right now, visiting her parents. She told me she found the approval process for the Indian-developed vaccine, Covaxin, somewhat bewildering.
The language says that it has been approved to be used in a clinical trial mode. That's very confusing to any scientist who is familiar with clinical trials, because as you know, in a clinical trial, it's randomized and double-blinded, and you need a comparison in order to understand the efficacy of the vaccine. So you cannot really roll it out in a clinical trial mode. So the Covaxin, the approval is rather ambiguous. There's a little bit of safety data, but no efficacy data. So I'm a little bit perplexed.
But at this point, we don't know yet whether the Covaxin will be administered. It's been given approval. But we do know that the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is being produced in millions of doses and produced and manufactured right in India. So that's kind of on schedule to be administered, isn't it?
Yes, that is. And I think that is a very hopeful and positive step for India. And I think that the January 1st, when this vaccine was first approved, I felt this was a landmark moment for India. And the price of the vaccine being very affordable is very good news for a country like India.
Will Indians have to pay for it themselves, or is it a cost that the Indian government will absorb?
So mostly the Indian government is going to absorb the cost, but even if someone had to pay out of pocket, it's very, very cheap. It's 200 rupees, which is essentially $3 to $4.
Can you give us a sense of how Indians are feeling as this massive and unprecedented vaccine rollout begins?
Some people are very, very excited, and then some people are rather skeptical. I'd have to say that India's immunization platform is incredibly strong compared to the globe, and they have had large number of successes in the history of immunization. So people are excited. And even in rural areas, there has been several dry runs of the vaccines. And so I think that the system is very prepared. But I think that there is a vaccine hesitancy, like in all countries. People want more data. People want to see the efficacy and the real-world effectiveness of the vaccine as it rolled out in different age groups, with people with different comorbidities, people who are taking different kind of medications. So there is a bit of apprehension as well. But people are also confused about the choices, right? Which, if I could afford all of them, which one should I actually get for my parents? So I have been receiving a lot of comments on that note.
Well, I see that you posted on Twitter your parents' own confusion about it. I mean, how's that conversation going in terms of them asking you which one they should get?
I'd be honest, I have asked them to wait for the mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer and the BioNTech, because that's probably what I'm going to get in the United States. And I think that they will be not freely available, not sponsored by the government, because it's possibly not feasible, but they will be available for market, and the market will be opened up in March or April. That's what I told them, that to just wait a little bit.
Here in the U.S., the CDC has guidelines for who gets a vaccine first and the order that follows. Are things similar in India?
Yes, I think that the first tier, the first priority tier is, of course, like in any country, are the healthcare professionals. The second tier is essential workers. And the third tier is people aged 50 plus, and then people with comorbidities, fairly similar. And then, of course, vaccine is not mandatory, but you have to register in an app. That's the plan, because there is no digital health ID that is universal in India. So you have to use what is known as the Aadhaar card, and so that the government can track the vaccination and the vaccine uptake. Schools and community centers will also be used for vaccination. And there will be buy-in sought from religious and community leaders, because that's something which you really need in order to maximize the vaccine uptake.
I read that India may actually use its election infrastructure to help in administering the vaccines. Can you explain that?
Yes, they are talking about that organized machinery of really getting a booth set up, getting reaching very remote areas, because everybody has access to an electronic voting center, be it ballot, be it different formats and different. And it's not going to be the same approach in the big urban metros in India versus a remote area in the Himalayas. It's going to be very different. But I think that the whole system is really scaling up. And I think this has also become an issue for India to demonstrate that they can do it.
India is a famously crowded country, lots of people in close quarters. When you walk out in the streets in Kolkata, is everybody masked? I mean, is there social distancing? How does it really look on the streets?
You know, my parents have a farmhouse in a village in Birbhum in West Bengal. And when I went there, there's almost no use of mask. The coronavirus, it seemed like a distant reality to the village people. But in the urban metros, I see a lot of mask wearing, and particularly among the household help and the cab drivers and the daily wage earners, I see a lot of adherence to mask wearing. And there is no political debate around wearing of masks. So that has certainly, that universal mandate and consolidation of messaging has certainly been helpful.
Professor of Epidemiology Brahmar Mukherjee in Kolkata, India. She teaches at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Thanks so much, Professor Mukherjee.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
India is preparing to join more than 24 countries which are starting to administer vaccinations against the coronavirus, but the path ahead is looking very different across the globe. There's a fraught debate playing out over the vaccine dosing schedule. Some say the second of two doses can happen 3 to 4 weeks after the first one. Others suggest even more time in between doses. That would mean more people could get their first dose sooner. Today, the WHO's panel of vaccine experts, also known as SAGE, gave its recommendations for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. Here's SAGE Chair Dr. Alejandro Cravioto.
SAGE recommends the administration of two doses of this vaccine within 21 to 28 days.
So two doses, 3 to 4 weeks apart. That's the same schedule the manufacturers tested. It's also the one that the U.S. will follow. In the United Kingdom, though, people can wait as long as 12 weeks for their second dose. That's because of a recent spike in new infections. Dr. Cravioto says the WHO recommendations also come with exceptions for countries in certain circumstances, like those with a short supply of vaccines.
To delay the administration of the second dose for a few weeks in order to maximize the number of individuals benefiting from a first dose.
Also taking part in today's press conference, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. He had an update from the group looking into the origins of the pandemic. Dr. Tedros says its members started traveling to China yesterday, only to discover that Beijing has yet to issue permission for them to enter the country.
I'm very disappointed with this news, given that two members had already begun their journeys and others were not able to travel at the last minute. We're eager to get the mission underway as soon as possible.
He says the Chinese government is now expediting its internal process. When President-elect Biden takes office in a few short weeks, he will face a host of foreign policy challenges. One of the big ones is the war in Afghanistan. The Trump administration signed an agreement with the Taliban last February, where the Taliban agreed not to attack American forces. In return, the U.S. said it would pull American troops out of the country. The Taliban also promised to negotiate a separate deal with the Afghan government. Today, Afghan officials are getting ready to resume talks with the Taliban. The world's Shirin Jafari has been following the story. Shirin, what's the latest?
Hey, Carol. So the representatives from each side are going to be meeting in the Persian Gulf country of Qatar. Lots of extremely difficult topics to discuss here, Carol. The trickiest of them is the issue of power sharing, meaning who will govern Afghanistan once the American troops are gone. And there's also the question of whether there will be a ceasefire anytime soon. So those are some of the major topics that the different sides are going to be discussing. Now, I must point out that this is not the first time that the Taliban and the Afghan government are meeting. These negotiations have been going on for a while. They started back in September, and progress has been very slow because, you know, think about it. These are sides that have been fighting one another for the past two decades, and now they have to come together and negotiate the future of their country. So it's going to be a while until they can build trust and find common grounds.
Sharon, what are you hearing from people in Afghanistan about how they see these talks?
Well, of course, everybody wants the war to end, right? But what's really making people worried is the level of violence in Afghanistan in recent weeks. There have been a number of targeted attacks against journalists and activists, members of civil society in general. And just to give you a sense, Carol, at least 8 activists or journalists have died in the past 2 months alone. So journalists and activists are living in constant fear right now. And that's what Farahnaz Rutan told me. She's an Afghan journalist and a TV presenter. She says there's a wave of bloodshed in this country right now. She describes cities like Kabul as a slaughterhouse for journalists and activists.
That's unbelievable. I mean, do we know who's behind these killings and why they're targeting journalists and activists?
The Islamic State has taken responsibility for some of these attacks, but then a lot of them go unclaimed. There are all sorts of debates about who might be behind them. Some people say it's the Taliban because they want to use violence to increase their leverage in the negotiations. And then there are other people who say these are people connected to the government because they don't want the Taliban to come to power. And then others blame people who benefit financially from the war and they want the status quo to continue. So it's really hard to know who exactly is behind them. But then yesterday, the spokesman for the American forces in Afghanistan tweeted that for peace to succeed, the Taliban has to stop its unclaimed attacks on journalists. But then the Taliban, if you ask the Taliban, they deny taking any civilian life.
So given the level of violence and the slow pace of negotiations, what are Afghans hoping these talks will achieve?
I asked Farahnaz Rutan, the journalist, how she sees the prospects for these talks. She said, listen, I've been to some of these negotiations in Doha before, and I've heard the points of view of the Taliban and the government, the Americans too. And then at the end of the day, what everybody wants to know is who is going to take power in Afghanistan when the Americans leave. That's the main goal that these negotiations have. For now, Frutan told me she has decided to leave Afghanistan. She was getting a lot of threats. And she said, you know, a lot of journalists like her have had to either leave or go into hiding or tone down what they say online.
And she must be worried about herself as well in that regard.
Absolutely.
The World's Shirin Jafari. Thanks for the update.
You're welcome, Carol.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. President Trump continues to falsely claim that he won November's election, and he's encouraging his supporters to head to Washington tomorrow to support his claim. District of Columbia Mayor Muriel Bowser has asked the National Guard for help and told people to avoid confrontations.
We will not allow people to incite violence, intimidate our residents, or cause destruction in our city.
Now, this is America, so everyone has the right to peacefully protest, but D.C.'s attorney general said they will not tolerate criminal behavior from groups that, quote, promote hate on a racial and religious basis. This challenge, where do you draw the line between free expression and extremism, is faced by many governments. In Indonesia, a group called the Islamic Defenders Front is waging a vigilante campaign against anyone its members deem impure. Many Indonesians think the group is over the top. But it's also proving to be a resilient force, even defying a government ban. Here's the world's Patrick Nguyen with our story.
By the time you hear this, it's too late. The cavalry has arrived. Hundreds of guys on motorbikes, dressed in white robes, waving bamboo sticks. They go after gamblers, sex workers, nightclubs. Here in this YouTube video, they're going after a little cafe that sold food during the fasting month of Ramadan, surrounding the place as the owner looks terrified. Meet the Islamic Defenders Front, one of the biggest vigilante groups in Asia. They're self-appointed morality police. If you had to distill their message, it's basically,
this is against Sharia. This is against Sharia. People who do not comply with the Sharia, God will punish. Something like that.
That's Jajang Jaroni, an Indonesian scholar who studies the group. In Indonesian, they are called Front Pembela Islam, or FPI. And Jajang has seen them in action, going out on raids against impure places, roughing up people at karaoke joints, sometimes coming back with blood on their robes.
They usually came with a big number, hundreds, and people cannot stop them.
And they've been doing this for like 20 years. They started small, then moved on to bigger targets, like an LGBTQ film festival in the capital, Jakarta. Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar! They usually don't hurt their subjects, but they're scary. And in this case, they disrupted the film festival. And that just makes people think, maybe it would be easier to just retreat into the shadows. Jajang, the scholar, says that's how the FPI wins.
FPI is a thug.
FPI, they're thugs, he says. Now, Indonesia is not Saudi Arabia, where religion is supreme. It's a democracy. You can buy beer at 7-Eleven, the nightclubs get pretty wild, and more people wear jeans than robes. Jajang says most Indonesians do not think puritanical street justice is okay. So how do the FPI vigilantes get away with this? Well, it helps to understand the leader of this movement, Habib Rizieq. I reached out to someone who spent time with Rizieq, a man named Ian Wilson.
I first met Habib Rizieq in Aceh in the aftermath of the tsunami.
The 2004 tsunami devastated the province of Aceh. More than 230,000 people died. Bodies were piled on the shoreline. Ian Wilson, who speaks fluent Indonesian, was there to translate for aid workers. And that's when he came across this group on the beach, the Islamic Defenders Front.
And they were doing some pretty awful and difficult work retrieving bodies after the tsunami and giving them Islamic burials.
Wilson was struck by the charisma of Habib Rizieq, their spiritual leader. And later, he got himself invited to Rizieq's compound back in Jakarta.
We drank tea and we talked. He's animated. He's intense. He's a charismatic figure in that he has a sharp wit. He has a sharp mind.
And Rizieq definitely knows how to work a crowd. He talks about things that bother working-class Indonesians, that the cops are corrupt, that foreign corporations pay them crap wages to make stuff for rich Westerners. Ian Wilson says it all resonates.
The evils of an immoral capitalism and that, you know, the answer to this was a particular kind of Islamic piety and for Islam to guide the direction of the country.
That is their mission. Sharia law nationwide. This is the cure-all. Wilson, now a political scholar at Murdoch University in Australia, says Rizieq also gets people hyped up by railing against pop culture.
So that can include everything from popular music. For example, they engaged in protests against Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga tetap menyanyikan lagu Judas. Lady Gaga
tetap menyanyikan lagu-lagu homo dan lesbianisme, saudara. That was in 2012. Lady Gaga even canceled a planned concert in Jakarta after Rizieq threatened her with chaos. So what to do about the Islamic Defenders Front? That's been a tough question for the Indonesian government. Last week, it finally found an answer. It banned the FPI. Members said, nice try, we'll just start a new group with a new name. Ian Wilson says it's not clear how this is going to play out. Yes, he says, they are an irritating, thuggish organization.
But the fact that they're simply annoying isn't grounds for them to be banned.
Many inside Indonesia's government disagree. They say this is a terrorist group. It's time to lock them up. Not for nothing, Rizieq has been in and out of prison a lot. usually for disrupting public order. This is his most recent run-in with the law.
A radical Indonesian cleric turned himself in to authorities on Saturday after he was accused of inciting people to breach pandemic restrictions by holding events with large crowds.
Yep, his rallies have been COVID super spreaders. That's why Rizik is in jail now. And that one really bothered a lot of people, says Jajang, the professor.
Why the hell are you doing this? Huh? At the end of the day, public support to him will decline because of his bad reputation.
In December, before Rizik went to jail, police cars were trailing him one night. And his bodyguards apparently didn't like that. There was a skirmish, a shootout, and police end up killing six of the vigilantes. Now, in Indonesia, like everywhere now, people live in social media bubbles. So if you hate this group, the incident proves it. They're rebels and thugs. And if you like them, well, the guys who died were brutally martyred by the immoral state.
You see memes that are holding up the six who died as martyrs to the broader cause.
Ian Wilson says martyrdom is oxygen for this movement, and it has had some real success. A few years ago, Rizik and his followers went after the governor of Jakarta. They played on the fact that he's ethnically Chinese, that he's Christian, and they accused him of disrespecting Islam. It worked. The governor of the capital of Indonesia actually went to prison for 2 years on a weak charge of blasphemy. And that is the power of this vigilante movement, which always says God is on its side. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
You're listening to The World. It's evening in Khartoum, Sudan. You're not having dinner or hanging with your family. You're in your car, waiting in line for gas.
And I see your gas is almost out.
Yes, almost out.
So today, you couldn't wait.
I will celebrate.
Celebrating a full tank, and what's next for Sudan's economy, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, you're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. If you want to see the power of vaccines to end a disease outbreak, one place to visit is the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's been hit with the Ebola virus more than 10 times since the 1970s. But the latest outbreak that started in 2018 was stopped in its tracks by a very successful vaccine rollout. To learn more about why the Congo was so successful, I'm joined by Dr. Alassane Touré, who led the WHO's vaccine program during the latest Ebola outbreak. He joins us from Paris. Dr. Touré, in the last 2 years, hundreds of thousands of people have been vaccinated for Ebola in Congo. That's a massive effort. What were the major logistical challenges you faced in getting people vaccinated?
The last 2 years, we vaccinated more than 400,000 people in the DRC. The challenges was enormous in terms of logistics and in terms of acceptance of the communities. And most of them was community reticence for the beginning in the Equator province. And then when we moved to the province of Eastern Congo, like Goma, the challenge changed because the area is poor and there's no infrastructure adapted to our activities. So we need to improve and adapt our strategies and work to be able to overcome the disease.
I understand that many people in the Congo were skeptical of the Ebola vaccine. What, in your experience, is the best way to build trust in the community around vaccines?
When you have an effective vaccine, you have a big chance to protect people, but you need first to convince them. For that, you need to be honest with them, transparent, and let them ask all the concern and give them responses, because people have to trust in science, and there is trust in science when we are transparent with them, when we give them all the information.
Wasn't another important aspect the use of local people, local healthcare workers, to deliver those messages?
This is one of the main lessons we learn. When you use the local people, when you empower them to lead themselves, that will help you to overcome all the community reticence. So we allow the community itself by using the local healthcare workers to organize and implement fee activities. Also, you need to adapt the strategies according to the community feedback.
Dr. Ture, when you look ahead to the rollout of the COVID vaccine in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, do you see any different challenges than you did with the Ebola vaccine?
First, we need to strengthen the community engagement. So I used to say that when we have community acceptance, it's like 90% of the work is already done because the rest is a technical and logistic. And when we have big support and partners, we can overcome technical issues and logistic issues. One of the challenges is not only in DRC, everywhere in the world. We don't have one vaccine. We have several kind of vaccine for COVID-19. And some people will try to say why the American people take Pfizer vaccines or they took Moderna vaccine, and why are you bringing us another vaccines? So this is also some kind of communication we have to anticipate now, some kind of rumors we have to anticipate now.
So the education on these issues has to start now in order to make it a smooth process.
Now, yes.
Dr. Alassane Touré led the WHO's vaccine program during the latest Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's been speaking to us from Paris. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol.
For another view on the Democratic Republic of Congo's experience with vaccinations and what lessons we can apply to today's vaccine challenge, we turn to Anne Remoyne. She's a professor of epidemiology at UCLA and an expert on public health systems in both the Democratic Republic of Congo as well as North America. Anne Remoyne, like a few of the COVID-19 vaccines, the Ebola vaccine that was used in the DRC requires really cold storage. At the time, it was the largest rollout of a vaccine that required those ultra-cold temperatures to store it. What other similarities do you see between the Ebola vaccine and the COVID-19 vaccine?
In DRC, the Ministry of Health was able to work with the World Health Organization and other organizations to effectively roll out mass vaccination campaigns with this vaccine, which required very low temperatures, similar temperatures to the Pfizer vaccine, and were able to conduct vaccination campaigns in extremely remote, hard to access areas. And I think we can learn a lot from this experience.
You've studied the numbers in the U.S. Compare that to vaccination rollouts in other places for COVID or your past experiences working with Ebola. I mean, is the U.S. where it should be right now?
We in the United States are not used to conducting mass vaccination campaigns. It's been a long time since we've been in this situation. So we need to really think about how mass vaccination campaigns should be run and get creative as they do in places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and think about how best to reach all populations as quickly as possible when we have the vaccine stock in hand.
And what can the U.S. learn from the experience of Democratic Republic of Congo and getting the Ebola vaccine deployed?
The key here is getting the community involved and making sure that any concerns are addressed up front, having really good public health messaging, using community leaders to be able to ensure that there's acceptance. There's also quite a bit of logistics planning that goes into place. I mean, certainly that's what's happening right now.
As somebody who observes both regions, what are your observations about how the pandemic is happening in both places?
We know that in places like DRC, we've seen lower rates. We've seen lower rates throughout many places in Africa. And it could be for a variety of reasons. In high resource settings, the population skews towards older population, whereas in places like the DRC, you have a much younger population. And we know that the severe outcomes and death rates are much higher, significantly higher in populations that are older. It could have something to do with prior vaccinations, could have to do with it transmitting less effectively in warmer settings. We're now starting to see variants, and we've now started to see another increase in cases in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for example.
Anne Ramoyne, you're someone who knows the importance of vaccine programs to save lives, and you've worked in two very different settings, the Democratic Republic of Congo and the U.S. How do you reflect on the fact that the general public in the U.S. may get this vaccine for COVID-19 before vulnerable populations in the DRC?
Well, I think this is something that very much needs to be addressed. We need to have equity in vaccine distribution because we know that infections anywhere are infections everywhere. The world is very interconnected. So it's critical that we find a way to be able to guarantee access to vaccines in low resource settings as well.
Anne Ramoyne is a professor of epidemiology at UCLA and a public health expert in North America and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
The nation of Sudan is entering a new era. Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok recently tweeted that out. After 3 decades of global isolation, Sudan officially rejoins the international community. The Prime Minister wrote that because Sudan has been removed from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. Getting off the list means no more sanctions. As the world's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports, it's big news for a country that's working to normalize its economy.
It's 7 p.m. on a weekday in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. Instead of hanging with his friends, Mohamed Abdullatif is waiting in his car, hoping to fill up on fuel. This is a weekly ritual.
Can I see your gas is almost out?
Yes, almost out, yes.
So today you couldn't wait.
I will celebrate. I will make a party after the fuel in this.
Abdullatif switches to Arabic and tells me how he raced to get to this gas station. He rushed over here after seeing on a Facebook group that this line was short. But he's already been waiting for nearly an hour, and there are still dozens of cars ahead of him. That's nothing, Abdullatif tells me. One time, he had to wait 6 hours for gas.
Yeah, 6 hours.
This is the reality of living in Sudan, he tells me. Long lines and high prices for basic commodities like fuel and bread. Protests over these same issues led to the ousting of dictator Omar al-Bashir last year. But even now, frustration is high, says Mohamed Ismail Mohamed Ali. He owns a camera repair shop in Khartoum. Ali is in the middle of fixing a digital camera for a client. After years of sanctions, he says it's difficult to import camera components for his business. So he uses whatever used parts he can find instead. Ali says the state of the economy is really discouraging. The new civilian-led government is not coming through with one of its promises. But Ali says he was happy about the U.S. removing Sudan from the terror list recently. Still, the benefits of the revolution are not being felt, he says. If he had the chance, Ali tells me he would leave Sudan. He would even risk crossing the Mediterranean, like other young Sudanese have done, just for the chance to find a future elsewhere. Sudan has still not shed its past under the military regime of Bashir, says Sidgi Kabalo. He's an economist in Khartoum.
The economy is still owned and run by the old regime. They are the same people. And they are dominating local trade and foreign trade.
Kabalo says the new civilian-led government under Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok also needs to remake the financial system, reform the banking sector, and address currency instability. At this small market in Khartoum, lots of goods are on sale, from electronics to clothing. It's busy. Never mind that the power just went out. That happens often here. Omar Ahmed sells men's button-down shirts. They're neatly folded on the shelves.
يلا نحن شنو سعر الصرف ده اكبر مشكله هسه دي المشكله المهدده البلد كلها ما نحن مهدده السودان
كله. Ahmed explains how he buys these shirts from importers who operate in US dollars, but the exchange rate with the Sudanese pound is unstable. People buy dollars on the black market at 5 times the official rate. Ahmed says the price of his shirts jumped 25% overnight, so he needs to raise his prices yet again. Ahmed says the cost of living in Sudan is going up too, but he says he's optimistic about where the country is going. He took part in last year's massive protest. Now, Ahmed says Sudanese need to be patient. Ahmed points out that the conversation we're having about the economy and quality of life is happening out in the open, right here in the market. This would not have been possible under the previous regime, he tells me. And that, Ahmed says, is progress. For The World, I'm Halima Gekandi, Khartoum, Sudan.
A major feud in the Arab world eased up today. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain ended a 3-year blockade of Qatar. The agreement between the American allies will open up Qatar's land, air, and sea borders and restore ties between the countries. To discuss this, we turn to Nabil Nawara. He's an independent analyst of the Gulf region. Nabil, tell us why this news is so significant and what does it mean for the U.S.?
Well, actually, it is significant because after more than 3 years, 4 countries, namely Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE, and Egypt, ended their blockade and their disagreement with Qatar, which actually was unprecedented, and it reached limits and that cannot be easily resolved. However, the states and principally Saudi Arabia thinks it's time to end the crisis because of regional and international pressures. Now, again, it's important to know that this reconciliation, if we may say, is superficial. The resolution of the crisis did not address the root differences between Qatar on one hand and Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain on the other hand.
I want to get to a more fundamental question, though. Where does the U.S. fit into all of this? Why does it matter to the U.S.?
Well, actually, the U.S. administration, the Trump administration, and the Middle East envoy, Jared Kushner, played a crucial role in this reconciliation. And they exerted a lot of pressure on the GCC states to resolve their differences. And this is a part of it. And they want to have a unified GCC to confront regional adversaries, namely Iran. And this came mainly from the Trump administration's pressure on these countries to resolve their issues and their disputes.
Why was Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain mad at Qatar in the first place?
Well, Saudi Arabia attempts to exercise regional hegemony, and being part of the GCC, Saudi Arabia expects other GCC states to follow its lead. Qatar, actually, especially after 2011, after covering the events of the Arab Spring and supported in many ways the Arab Spring movements across the Arab world, this is, of course, was seen as a threat to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which on the other hand supported what some people say the counter-revolutions in the Arab world.
So who blinked? I mean, there's an agreement now. Who agreed with whom? Who gave in?
Well, actually, every party claims it is the winning party. I mean, if you may say, Qatar, on one hand, was able to survive for 3 years. The quartet placed 13 demands. None of these 13 demands are implemented the way they were placed in the beginning of the rift.
Nabil Nawara is an independent analyst of the Gulf region. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, new details continue to come out about the massive computer hack discovered last month that targeted the U.S. government and some U.S. businesses. More information about Russia's involvement is just ahead. The stories we bring you on The World give you a lot to think about and, of course, discuss. Join the conversation with us on the global stories of the day. We're on Twitter, at The World, or you can find me tweeting about satire. I'm at Global Cartoons. Now to a story we've been following for several weeks, the big hack. Last month, some of the U.S. government's largest agencies were breached. Now we know more than 250 government departments and businesses were impacted. Security experts are pointing the finger at Russia. Austin Burglass has been following this. He's a former FBI agent, where he was in charge of the FBI's New York office cyber branch. He's now with BlueVoyant, a cybersecurity company. Austin Burglass, first of all, in the weeks since this hack first came to light, what new information have we learned?
What we've learned is that this was something called a supply chain hack. It was a hack into a company called SolarWinds. And since SolarWinds provides software and technology for many organizations, the Russians were able to go through their SolarWinds hack and then compromise private and governmental agencies.
What is a supply chain hack?
A supply chain hack is a compromise of any provider of technology or services for a client. And with each one of those companies that they're outsourcing that work to, they're building the supply chain. And anywhere along that supply chain, if there is a compromise, it can poison that entire supply chain.
It's been a number of weeks since the news first broke. Anything really important that we've learned in the interim since we first heard of it?
One thing is that we learned as a community is the frailty of the supply chain, how important that vetting and ensuring the trusted relationship with vendors is secure. We've also learned that the Russians in particular, how vast and extensive their attempts to compromise both government and private organizations here in the States are.
What is the evidence that Russia did this? I mean, everybody seems to think that that's the case, but what is the real evidence that, it is Russia?
So attribution is obtained in two ways. It's the combination of indicators of compromise, so technical indicators that the U.S. government can tie back to a certain entity. And then number two is something called TTPs, or tactics and procedures. This is the way that the attack is performed. It's kind of a calling card. The government saw indicators of compromise and TTPs that were indicative of the SVR, or a unit in Russia that is being fingered for this attack.
You know, it still feels like this kind of is a slow motion story. You know, we've been hearing about it for weeks. It's a huge deal. So what's been the response? What changes have the U.S. government made since this huge hack was discovered?
Well, they're putting out bulletins. They put out something called indicators of compromise, meaning the actual indicators that the bad guys were using for this attack that private organizations and government agencies can use to better protect against this type of attack. And they're also looking to improve the way that the government interacts with the private sector. This is an ongoing process. And in order to protect against these types of sophisticated attacks, you oftentimes have to move at computer speed. And that's not necessarily always possible. So the public-private partnership that is always in stages of improvement, this is just highlighting the need for that.
Should we assume there's something more dramatic going on behind the scenes to correct this or address it? Because it sounds kind of lame. I mean, posting a notice about what you might do to improve the system and, gee, watch out for this seems, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, this is highlighting big problems that the U.S. government is always facing, which is the recent head of CISA, Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency, was recently fired by the president. So leadership in a constant state of flux in the most important agency in the government for cybersecurity, when that position is politically driven and we see individuals in that position being moved on for political reasons is always an issue, then you always have cybersecurity personnel in the U.S. government is always understaffed based on funding and the ability to hold qualified individuals in those positions. So this is just another instance highlighting the need for more strategy, more policy, more emphasis on cybersecurity inside the U.S. government, and then highlighting also the need for that relationship between the private and public sector.
Austin Burglass is a former FBI agent where he was in charge of the FBI's New York office cyber branch. He's now with the cybersecurity company BlueVoyant. Thanks so much, Austin.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
One of Mexico's most beloved singer-songwriters died last week in Mexico City. Armando Manzanero, one of Mexico's great romantic composers, was 86. Manzanero had been hospitalized for COVID-19 and placed on a ventilator. His son said the cause of death was cardiac arrest following complications from kidney problems. Still, it's another grim reminder for Mexico of the pandemic's heavy toll. More than 125,000 people there have died from COVID-19, and close to 1,000 people in Mexico have now been dying each day from the disease. But there's at least some hopeful news in Mexico this week. The country has approved the AstraZeneca vaccine for emergency use to fight the coronavirus. But back to Manzanero, his death was announced on national television by Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
Don Armando Manzanero, un gran compositor, de lo mejor del país.
Obrador called Manzanero a great composer, also a sensible man on social issues, a man of the people.
Somos novios, pues los dos sentimos mutuo amor profundo. Y con eso ya ganamos lo más grande de este mundo.
Manzanero became well known for songs like Somos Novios, first recorded in 1968. Billboard magazine listed it as one of the 50 greatest songs in the history of Latin music. Manzanero wrote more than 400 songs during his seven-decade career. He worked with musical icons ranging from Frank Sinatra to Andrea Bocelli to Elvis Presley. Here's Presley's rendition of Manzanero's song.
It's impossible. Tell the sun to leave the sky. It's just impossible.
6 years ago, Manzanero received a Lifetime Achievement Grammy. He said, "A song has to be written with sincerity and be written to last."
Adoro la calle en que nos dimos, la noche cuando nos conocimos. Adoro las cosas que me dices, nuestros ratos felices, los adoro, vida mía.
Mexico's Armando Manzanero, one of that country's greatest romantic composers. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
From PRX.